Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up on the program today, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints reverses a policy that labeled same-sex couples apostates and generally prevented the children of same-sex parents from joining the faith. Under a new law, four Utah women ask for a second look at their sexual assault cases. And the exemption to a new law governing the placement of hidden GPS devices on Utah cars. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce is here. And hi, Dave. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks.
We've also got Government and Politics Editor Dan Harry. Good morning and welcome to you, Dan.
Good morning.
And Editorial Page Editor and Columnist George Pyle. Welcome, George.
Good morning.
You can join this conversation by posting your questions at sltrib.com or calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet us. We are at KCPW. Let's begin with the news that broke yesterday, David Noyce, about a reversal of policy from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And this was an undoing of something that was put in place a few years back. Tell us what happened, David.
This policy was originally put in place in November of 2015. At least that's when it leaked out. This was a policy, as you described, that prevented children of same-sex member couples prevented them from joining the church, as in being baptized, having a ritual called baby blessings, and also declared that members living in a same-sex relationship, a sexual relationship, were apostates and could be subject to disciplinary proceedings by the church. And yesterday, they essentially did away with all of that. It's virtually unprecedented for something that happened that quickly on something that visible.
Right. Wasn't it that previously, if you had same-sex parents and you wanted to be a member of the faith, you had to sort of renounce them or something like that if you wanted to be baptized?
That was part of the policy, too. Okay. That came out, and that, although that was not explicitly stated in what was released yesterday, the implication is, of course, that that's gone by the wayside also.
What's the explanation for this change of policy, or why now?
Well, I guess the explanation would be God changed his mind really fast from
right.
members. It was obviously very divisive. It tore apart a lot of members, even members who may not have always been sympathetic to LGBTQ causes, especially the children aspect. I think the thing preventing children from joining the church, which they would have to get their parents' permission anyway under any circumstances, that was very divisive. So I think that's one reason why, but it was interesting how it came about. I don't know if you want to discuss this or not, but President Nelson, who's the president of the church now, came in a year ago this past January, is the one who sort of upped the ante on this policy. In January of 2016, just a few months after the policy came out, he's the one who gave a speech in Hawaii basically declaring that it was a revelation from God to his predecessor, Thomas S. Monson, and that all the brethren agreed with it, all the high-ranking apostles agreed with this policy. So yesterday, they essentially talked about revelation and apparently a revelation saying it's time to do away with that policy.
And the sort of the idea that you can have, you know, revelation after revelation, ongoing changes within
right.
the faith is sort of how a faith like this can turn on a dime.
It's built into the doctrine, which is sort of theologically convenient also
right.
if you want to make a change quickly.
Is the church changing its position, you know, more generally on same-sex marriage or homosexuality?
No. As a matter of fact, they emphasized that in their release yesterday, that the doctrine as they see it on homosexuality is the same, which is that same-sex attraction is fine, but you can't act on it. And they're still very much against same-sex marriage.
Does the fact that this is just ahead of the, you know, the church's spring conference weekend, does that play into this or the timing of this at all? I guess you can't predict the you know, when changes like this are going to happen.
Obviously, I don't know exactly on that, but this would be a hard thing to necessarily unveil at conference. These kinds of reversals or policy changes are normally not announced at conference. They usually do this in advance or at another time. I mean, we've seen since President Nelson came in that there have been a ton of changes. So many that come out. Many come out outside of conference, although they usually do save a few for conference. But this would be the kind of thing that they would probably want to get out ahead of, which they did several years ago, too, when they changed the bishops' interviews, which had become sort of controversial. They did that a few weeks before conference also.
I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or tweet us. We are at KCPW. You know, it's interesting. I'm just what kind of reactions have there been within, you know, from within the faith and also among, especially among members of the faith who are LGBTQ and their families?
I think within the faith, it's been virtually universally positive, of course. It was interesting also because the release yesterday from the church classified it as positive news, very positive. Which by implication means the previous policy probably was negative and or at least seen that way. So almost universally relieved, happy, rejoicing. However, there's a lot of pain and a lot of hurt that's still there, and a lot of pain and hurt that 3.5 years of it that according to some advocates may have even cost some people their lives. It was seen at least by many advocates as a contributing factor to suicide ideation and things like that.
Right, that Utah's high youth suicide rate has been influenced by this, that you know, the church's positions on this or on the sort of worthiness, I guess, of gay people, and that's been seen as something that has led to suicide. And in fact, the Tribune articles on this quoted some advocates for LGBTQ youth who pointed to that idea.
Exactly, and it's the kind of thing that, although I think even most of those advocates are certainly glad to see it's gone. Fred Karger, of course, who's a vehement critic of the LDS Church, was very positive in welcoming this yesterday. Surprising to me, actually. I expected him to certainly salute this step, but then to point out the long ways that he would think still needs to go. But he didn't, you know.
He's an LGBT rights activist, and he told the Tribune, this is a reporter, Ben Wood, that this is really big news. And part of his quote reads, "If they are allowed to live a full life, to be married to someone they love of the same sex and are welcomed back into the church, that is revolutionary." I mean, that's for him, that's a big jump from being deeply critical of the faith to this point.
Right, a guy who's leading a campaign to have the church lose its tax-exempt status. That's interesting. Part of his quote's a little off, of course. You know, I know how he means it, of course, but gay members were never barred. Never were barred from the church. They were always welcome at church. Now, welcome officially and versus feeling welcomed are two different things.
Right. He also said there's a potential for the Utah-based faith to take a leadership role among other churches that have been slow to respond to public attitudes towards sexual orientation and gender identity. Maybe I'll turn to George Pyle, columnist, for a response on that one. George, is this, you know, is that hoping for too much from the church, or is that what Mormon church leaders are doing here? Is taking that leadership role in changing attitudes about people who are LGBTQ?
Well, churches move, or at least we used to think they move just glacially. That the whole point of having a church, whether it's this church or just about any other, is that they don't flow with the winds. That they have some constant, unbending, permanent thing you can hang on to if you're a member of a particular faith, as all the world is losing its head and you don't. You stick to this, and it's supposed to be comforting. It's supposed to provide you with solace in a world that isn't always very nice. When it's the church that's the source of the pain, then sometimes they will have the decency to stop and think and say, now wait a minute, that's not what we're for as a church. We're for giving people comfort. And if this policy is doing the opposite of that, maybe we need to stop and rethink that. Now, it becomes difficult in this church or any church when you say that our principles are not just made up stuff by people. They come to us from God, and therefore we're not a democracy. The whole point is that we're not a democracy. We follow these rules. People join churches and stick with churches because they're not a democracy and because they give them some sense of permanence.
Constant.
So you can get some whiplash when these kinds of things happen. But at the same time, if you, as we've noted, I mean, people who could very well have spent yesterday saying, "I told you so. Why did it take you so long? How, you know, were you wrong then, or are you wrong now?" And, you know, they're mostly passing on that.
So some people did take that stance.
Well, and there's a lot of comments on that, and that's a reasonable reaction. But the people who want to be activists in this, the people who are hoping, I think, that the church will change further, maybe not this fast, but in the future, I mean, you don't build up any credit with them by making fun of them and making and saying, oh, well, we're the people who, you know, I can say this because I'm not trying to do anything, and, you know, they can...
because you're a columnist. Were
you hard of hearing before or are you now? Were you wrong then or are you wrong now? And when are you going to be wrong again? You know, you don't, if you're trying to move this iceberg, you don't make fun of them. You say thank you and you give people credit for being aware and thinking and reacting to things that even if you're not admitting that we're catching up with the world, you're allowing us how you may have caused people pain, and you didn't mean to do that.
Societal changes happening. David Noyce, also mass resignations when this policy was first unveiled that said, you know, children of same-sex couples aren't going to get baptized until they're adults, and they go through this whole process. There were a lot of people who said, "I'm not going to be a member of the faith anymore."
Right. Obviously, we can't document how many. It's private, right. But we do believe there were hundreds, if not thousands, of course, that did that. And now, when we went to some of the rallies and talked with people who were doing this, you found a lot of people first there who were not actually members. They were just there. Others who hadn't been active in the faith for a long time, but nonetheless did fill out their form and their letter and officially resigned from the church. So, yeah, there were resignations. This was something that was hotly debated, and it appears to be in the highest reaches of the church, because the statement yesterday also said that this came after much discussion with the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, between the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. So there was a lot of discussion apparently going on ever since this took hold.
Was there, the way that this was unveiled, you said there was a statement that was released at the church's official sort of PR website, but then the way that it was kind of conveyed to members was via another higher-up member of the church. This is Dallin Oaks. Dallin Oaks, mm-hmm. Yeah. How was it communicated?
They actually communicate this at before every general conference. They bring in a lot of their area leaders from around the world, and they were meeting yesterday morning, and that's where the First Presidency talked about this, and Dallin Oaks took the lead on this and announcing it to the members. Now, Dallin Oaks is Russell Nelson's right-hand man. He sat next to him in the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles for more than three decades, and now he's his first counselor, which is interesting.
I don't mean to cut you off, but there's been a trend of a number of big changes within the faith in the tenure of this church leader, the Russell M. Nelson. Can you recap some of those for us? I mean, this is the most recent in a series of things that seem like kind of revolutionary changes within the faith.
Yes. It depends. Some of them are very much insider baseball and other stuff that only members would really care or know about. But they were nonetheless big. Probably one of the biggest that almost virtually every member rejoiced at was the shortening of the 3-hour block on Sunday of meetings to 2 hours, of course. That's been widely studied by the church for a long time, and it was finally unveiled under President Nelson. Missionaries can now call home once a week to their parents. It used to be just called twice a year on Mother's Day and Christmas Day. Not Father's Day for some reason, but Mother's Day and Christmas Day. So that's a big change within the faith. Probably one of the biggest changes was the temple ceremonies were changed to be more gender inclusive. Many of the elements of temple ceremonies that were seen as sexist were changed and updated. Another thing that has been very hurtful to many women in the church and men. So that was a big change that only members in good standing will ever see.
Right.
But nonetheless, that was a huge change.
And the name change.
And the name change. Although, of course, they claim this is not a change. This is just not rebranding. They're just going what it should be. That was a big deal. And hammered again at last conference. I suspect we'll hear more about that again at this weekend.
This coming weekend. Going back to the change in policy for mm-hmm. children of LGBT or of same-sex couples and not labeling same-sex couples apostates, could that be a signal of bigger changes on this topic at some future date? I mean, Are we going to see more shifting from the faith? That's asking you to sort of speculate, but
That's what a lot of people would like to see. Of course, I mean, there are members who want the church to remove its opposition to same-sex marriage, and to someday see same-sex marriages solemnized in temples. Right now, of course, the leadership would say that's a doctrinal thing and that's not going to change. It's important to remember that this was always classified as a policy.
Right.
Policies are much easier to change. At one point, the church had a policy that even men who went on missions only went for 18 months. That didn't last long. So policies are generally seen as much easier to change. Doctrinal things would be seen as much more difficult to change, although they have.
Sure.
So a lot of people would like to see that. I do think the thing that was interesting about the policy when it was first implemented is it seemed to fly in the face of the steps the church had been taking toward more inclusivity with LGBTQ members.
Yeah. I don't mean to cut you off, but we are running low on time and ought to head to a break here in just a moment. But I want to just get one final comment from George Pyle on that part of it, on the sort of, there's doctrine is fixed, policy is changeable, but the faith can adapt to changing times because of this aspect that it has that is revelation. Any final comments before we head to a break?
Well, every human institution is made up of human beings, and whether they are in touch with God or not, they see the election results and they read the poll numbers and they see the amount of contributions in the plate, and they have to react to that, or they can go away like the Shakers did and there won't be any more of them, and they reasonably don't want it to go that way.
All right. That's George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of this past week's news in just a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce, Government and Politics Editor Dan Harry, and Editorial Page Editor George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. You can also tweet us. We are at KCPW. Dan Harry, there's a new law that allows victims of certain crimes, or maybe I should say alleged victims of certain crimes, I'm not certain how to phrase it, to have their cases re-examined if prosecutors don't file charges when they bring the case forward. I want to understand the law first, and then we can turn to a case where it's being utilized. What is this new law that allows a second look at crime, and where did it come from?
So the law is that if you're a sexual assault victim and you have gone to prosecutors, reported the crime, they've looked at it, and they've determined they will not prosecute, you can have a second bite at the apple, so to speak, that you can have the case reviewed entirely new, as though it hadn't been reviewed before by the Utah Attorney General's office.
Is it specific just to sexual assault cases?
That's my understanding, yeah.
I don't know. So there are four women who say that the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office mishandled their sexual assault reports, and they are now going to make use of this law. And that actually means they're dropping another avenue that they were pursuing. Can you tell us the story of these women, Dan?
Yeah, they had gone to this kind of extraordinary measure of asking the Supreme Court to have their cases reviewed. And Paul Cassell, University of Utah law professor, former federal judge, who's known as a victim's rights advocate, had filed this petition for them. And now they've dropped that. They said with this new law, they're going to utilize it, and so they're abandoning their petition to the Supreme Court, and they're going to the Attorney General's office and asking for review. The Attorney General's office could have reviewed these under the old statute, but you would have had to have abuse of discretion, I believe is it called, by the prosecutors, that they clearly abuse their discretion in deciding not to bring a case. That is no longer a requirement. They can review the case.
Prosecutors have a lot of power to decide whether a case moves forward.
Oh, yes.
Is this law an acknowledgement that there's a difference between, you know, securing a conviction and finding justice for victims?
I think it's a step in that direction. I mean, you're still having a prosecutor review your case and in the end ultimately deciding whether you're ever going to be able to get into a court of law to seek justice, right? It's still in the power of the prosecutor not to bring the case. And in the case of at least one of these four women, maybe more, but I know of at least one, where the prosecutor had told her, I believe that you were assaulted, I believe that you were raped, but I can't make this case in court. I can't get a conviction.
Hmm. The case of these four women who were going to use this avenue, this new law, to go to the Attorney General's office and have a review of their case. This was announced at a City Hall event. What was the event all about? This is at Salt Lake City Hall. It was a Start by Believing event.
Yes, yes.
A recognition that sometimes you have to do that. I mean, you're pointing out that a prosecutor says, yes, I believe you, but I can't do anything about it. Maybe I'll turn to George Pyle, editorial voice here. Another option for victims of sexual assault don't have their cases heard.
Yeah, well, these cases are often very difficult because you don't have necessarily the physical evidence or the eyewitnesses that you would have, you know, if somebody, you know, robs the liquor store or something. And so there are so many cases, and, you know, the Tribune has written about a lot of them, and our coverage has gotten cases brought back and prosecuted after they'd been ignored.
Right.
If a prosecutor doesn't bring a case, doesn't file charges in a case like this, and the woman knows she's been assaulted, then even if the prosecutor, from a purely logical, rational, legal standpoint, says, you know, I believe you, just face to face, I believe you, but I've got to think about going to court, standing before a jury, you know, having you testify and all the pain that's going to cause and everything. And at the end of the day, I don't think I have enough evidence to convict, so I'm not doing that. And prosecutors are supposed to do that. If they don't think it's going to result in a conviction, they don't bring the case, even if deep down inside they think something bad really happened. They're wasting everybody's time, and they're looking, and in some cases this may be not the way to look at it, but, you know, their batting average goes down.
Right.
So I knew a prosecutor once who, if the district attorney himself was prosecuting the case in court, then everybody knew it was a slam dunk. There was no question that he was going to lose. And if there was any question at all that this might go either way,
somebody else,
his deputies were in the case.
And sexual assault cases can often be the most difficult to prosecute successfully because many times you're talking about only two people were there.
Right.
So there are no eyewitnesses, generally speaking. Many times the physical evidence could be, you know, also evidence of a consensual relationship. So they are very difficult.
Is there a different bar for the Attorney General's office to look at these cases? I mean, what is, I guess, the review whereas a prosecutor can't, you know, is saying, I can't secure a conviction, the Attorney General's office is going to look at this and, you know, what is the next step for the cases that, say, these women are taking to the AG's office? They're going to, you know, Sean Reyes and his office is going to look at these cases and say, you know what, maybe there is something here to prosecute?
Yeah, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think then they would take on the case and prosecute it. I'm not sure.
Hmm.
It might be remanded to the original jurisdiction. I doubt that very much after they declined it. But
I mean, you could say that. I mean, the Attorney General has more resources, has more investigators, has more lawyers, and especially if it's in a smaller community, the prosecutor may be overworked and doesn't have staff to look at these kinds of things. Of course, the other thing that people are worried about is as was the case at Utah State, where there's the fear that the police and the prosecutors all say, well, yeah, he's raped people, but, you know, he's a football player, so he gets away with it. And that's the fear that people have.
I don't know that the prosecutors said exactly.
Well, no, I know, but that's the feeling that people have. I mean, when it was reported that somebody had been accused of rape on campus and hadn't been prosecuted and the person wasn't named properly because no charges had been filed, and we,
nothing happened.
And then later, when things happened, and it turned out that the accused was an athlete, I mean, how many people were surprised at that? I mean, because that, whether it's true or not, the reputation in a lot of places is that athletes or rich kids or other people can get away with stuff that other people can't get away with. And even if that's not what really happened, people worry about that. So having this extra layer of review kind of does kind of guard against the feeling, whether it's, you know, whether it's grounded or not, that local people know each other, turn their backs on things, whereas the state will come in and give it a fresh look and not be worried about friendships or status or anything like that, and will do what arguably should have been done in the first place.
It does seem like, though, that local prosecutors, knowing that this more expedited or clear path to having a review, would have them thinking twice or three times about, I really do have a case here. They know they're going to. It's almost like being reviewed by a judge again on an appeal. You know, you know you're going to, your work might be looked at again by someone else, an expert, and I think that might, you know, just increase prosecutions.
Yeah,
we build
that review into the judicial system. There's just assuming that people are going to make mistakes, and there's not really any reason why we shouldn't build it into the prosecutor system, just assuming that people are human and need to have somebody looking over their shoulder.
A second glance. I'm going to remind listeners to join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Dan, these women's cases, the sexual assault cases, they go to the Attorney General's office next, and then we just wait to see how that review goes. That's basically
right,
the next
right.
step.
Exactly.
That second look option is from a bill that was at this past the 2019 state legislative session. Another bill that became law from that session has to do with surveillance, specifically the placing of GPS devices on cars. There's this new law that prohibits most people from doing that, but Dan Harry, there's an exception to this new law. Tell us about that exception, if you would.
Private investigators. So if you hire a private investigator, they can do this legally still. There's one exception, and that is if the person whose vehicle you're placing this device on has a protective order against the private investigator's client.
Okay.
And so, it gave this very, what seems to be a very big loophole to this bill that was, you know, originally intended just to ban average non-police officers from doing this on your vehicles. Police officers already are under a constraint. They have to get a warrant to be able to do this.
But other people, I'm sorry,
but other people do not.
I mean, if I wanted to put a tracking device on your car up until the passage of this law, I could have just done that, Dan.
Yeah.
Not that I would have done that, but yeah. So private citizens didn't need a warrant. Do private investigators who are doing this, do they need with this exemption, they don't need a warrant?
No, they do not.
Hmm. There's the story that the Tribune reported of a woman whose ex-husband was following her every move with one of these devices. It was put on her car, not by her husband, who did have a protective order against, but by a private investigator. The husband faced some repercussions for that. The private investigator did not, right?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In
this case, it would put some burden of due diligence on the private investigator before they had a client that they'd go and do this for a client. They would have to check court records to see if there was a protective order. And if there was, they could not do it.
Okay. That's
so they could be in some legal liability if they went ahead and did that, or if they didn't check to see if indeed there was a protective order.
And that's what he would have had to have done in this case, or she, I'm not certain.
Yeah.
The chief of the Cottonwood Police Force says that the exception for private investigators is maybe problematic, and he actually helped run the bill at the state legislative session. He wanted to make it so that private investigators couldn't do this, but the legislature was persuaded otherwise.
Apparently and who knew, private investigators have a pretty good lobby on Capitol Hill. So they are not a lobby that you see actively, you know, testifying in committees and so forth, but apparently they're pretty powerful.
people generally, I mean, if I have a device on my car, I'm probably not going to know about that, right?
You will not know about it. Now, there are devices, and the story didn't get into this, but I think there are devices you can purchase to sweep your car that will detect these devices. So anybody who suspects this, or maybe all of us now, should look into those.
The story says that that oftentimes when they are found, it's during an oil change or car maintenance or whatever. Yeah, all right. George Pyle, the fact that you could, up until the passage of this law, you know, stick a tracking device on anybody's car is kind of surprising to me. What do you think about it?
Well, it's another example of how the technology runs ahead of our laws. I mean, you know, 30 years ago, you weren't going to write a law about tracking devices because there was no such thing. And then when they first started to be used, and sometimes police departments would put them on people's car, nobody thought they needed a warrant because there was no statutory law, there was no case law that addressed it. You know, it's like, you know, all kinds of, you know, where they argue about the Second Amendment and, you know, does it cover tanks and automatic weapons? Because there was no such thing when they wrote it. So how does it apply? And you have to catch up, and the law has to continually catch up to these things. That's why the legislature meets every year and messes things up. And that's why, and this is another thing where, you know, our 45 days and all these things get thrown together like, what it was, at $800,000 for somebody to get sound wall.
We might try and get into that a little bit.
And and only when the session is over and you have a chance to review all these things do sometimes even members of the legislature find out what they passed. Everything happens so fast. And if you know somebody and you get this paragraph inserted here and this clause put in there, and only when it gets to the governor's office or sometimes even after do we even say, oh, we did that. That's interesting.
Dan, just to close this out, I mean, the fact that a police force would need a warrant to do this, but a private investigator would not, it's just because the police force would be a representative of the government? I mean, is that I'm still, you know, kind of blown away by the fact that a private investigator doesn't need some sort of.
Yeah, I mean, you know, police have a lot of rules that normal people don't. I mean, you know, they have a certain higher standard of conduct, and this is part of that.
Could they hire a private investigator? Could the police hire a private investigator to go stick a tracking
around
device?
I don't know about that.
Right, dig into
it. Let's ask another law for that.
All right. We need to head to another break in the show here, and there's still more to come on the program, including limited Medicaid expansion that is now in place in the state of Utah. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Dan Harry, and George Pyle. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet us at KCPW. Dan Harry, government and politics editor. Medicaid expansion, as envisioned by the Utah legislature, not as envisioned by voters who said yes to a ballot initiative. There has been Medicaid expansion here in Utah, is what I'm trying to say, but it's different than what we originally thought we were going to get. The state got a waiver that has allowed it to launch its bridge plan. What does the waiver mean, and what is the bridge plan, Dan Harry?
So what it is it allows people to enroll in Medicaid that make up to 100% of the poverty level. So their estimates are up to 90,000 people can be eligible now for Medicaid that were not previously. And this is different from the initiative, Prop 3, in that that implemented full-blown Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion. It allowed people up to 138% of the federal poverty level to enroll in Medicaid. So that would have been another around 60,000 people that would have been eligible in Utah. So, I mean, this is a big step for those folks who now are suddenly eligible that can get health care that may not have been able to have access previously. but it doesn't go all the way. The legislature was, as they said, very fiscally cautious. They believe that in the out years that the tax imposed with this initiative would not cover its costs. The review that's required of initiatives, as is required with legislation, only goes 2 years out. And under that review, it covered it.
Right.
So they now have sent their legislative fiscal analyst to go further and do further and further projections, which, of course, like weather forecasts, the further out you get, the less chance of their being really accurate.
Reliable.
Are. But that's what they base this on, that the costs would outrun the revenue.
Just going back to Proposition 3, the costs of that, there was a tax there was $90 million in sales tax increase that went along with Proposition 3. Is that still there? And
yeah.
Is that what lawmakers are tapping into to pay for Medicaid now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But they will tap into that, and so that money will run out faster because you're spending more. The federal government is covering less.
Right.
Instead of the 10% that the state would have had to pay under the full-blown Medicaid expansion, the state now will pay 30%. And so that money will run through that money much, much more quickly.
Isn't that a budget buster? I mean, what's the difference between that as a budget buster and the other part?
Well, again, they're all talking about the out years, that okay. That this puts constraints and controls on it so that it will not have the kind of explosive growth that the legislators fear would happen under the full-blown Medicaid expansion.
Some healthcare advocates have reacted to this and said, well, look, basically they were advocating for Proposition 3, and as we know, they're upset with the legislature for having undone Proposition 3. And now that this is law, now that we have the waiver, have they changed their tune at all? Are they saying, wow, you got a waiver, we're on board with this? What's the response?
No, they really are still critical that the legislature should have allowed the initiative to go into place, that we would have we'd be spending less right now, state money, and we'd be insuring a lot more people.
There's another waiver that Utah wants to get so that we can – right now you said 70-30 is the split where the state is responsible for 30%.
Right.
We want that 90-10 split, but we need a waiver to
get
that.
We need another waiver. The legislature continually said during the session that they had assurances that this waiver that's been granted was coming. We don't know about that other waiver that is required to actually get the full federal reimbursement, and also work requirements. Mm-hmm. Work requirements are a part of this plan, although, interestingly, they're not being implemented. Courts in other states have blocked the work requirements that other states have used in the Medicaid programs, and so the decision here is simply not to implement that and hold it off for a later time if it is allowed by the courts.
How is so?
I don't know how that's done.
No, it's interesting. I mean, there's lawmaking, and then there's the implementation of laws,
yes.
And there's a gap between those two. But I'm
well,
you just get to choose what part of
a
law to.
There's a thing called rulemaking, and not many people pay attention to it. But it's the rules that are written to implement laws, and they're far more complicated and voluminous than laws are. But they're important. They govern how programs are implemented.
Okay, so at the moment, no work requirements envisioned. Will they come back?
They are envisioned.
Oh, okay.
They're just not in place.
Okay. Would they be in place at some future date, do we know?
If the courts allow them, yeah.
Okay. George Pyle comments on, I mean, we've kind of hashed this, we've gone through this before, but this week it actually became reality that we got the waiver and this form. I mean, it is expanding health coverage to some people.
Yes. I mean, you can say we've expanded Medicaid and, well, there are more people on it than or more people eligible for it. And I assume there will actually be more people on it when the word gets out than there were before. That's good. More people provided health care coverage is an unalloyed good, which the legislature doesn't seem to see, but it is. And only in Utah, well, and in Arkansas and Kansas, do they say that covering fewer people and spending more money to do it is fiscally responsible. They also completely ignore the research on the work requirement because they're scared to death that the undeserving poor will catch a break. They've got it completely backwards. All the Kaiser Health, whatever it is, research says that as you health insurance helps you get a job. You do not make people get a job in order to get health insurance. You give them health insurance so that they can keep their job, so that they can stay healthy, so they don't have to call in sick so much, so that they don't have to decide, well, if I don't have a job, I get Medicaid, and if I do have a job, I lose health care coverage. You don't want to put people in that box. So rational thought works against a work requirement. Being careful not to help the poor unless you absolutely are required to works for a work requirement. That's why the legislature wants one. That's why legislatures in other states have asked for it and been told by the courts that you can't do that. I'm not even really entirely sure what the court's rationale was other than it's stupid. But, you know, courts allow a lot of things that are stupid depending on what the law says.
I mean, the difference between Proposition 3 and what goes into effect is the difference in, do we know how many people, or it's 70 to 90,000 people are covered under what's happening
now? Yeah, they say
now.
Up to 90,000 people under the plan that's been implemented, and it'd be about 150,000 under the full Medicaid expansion.
Okay.
Yeah, and when they count and they say, well, you know, it's we're only getting 70-30, we wish we could get 90-10, you wonder, do they count... I mean, when they say, look at all the money the Department of Defense spends on Hill Air Force Base, they say not only does that money come to the state, but that money ripples through the economy, and the people who get the money spend the money, and so you have more restaurants and more hotels and more insurance salesmen and more doctors and more everything else. The money ripples through the economy and benefits everybody. They completely ignore that when they're talking about Medicaid reimbursement and the doctors and orderlies and nurses and clerks who would have jobs if we got all that money, and the money, and they would go out in the community and spend that, and they would all pay taxes on it. So it would boost the whole economy of the whole state, raising tax revenue beyond the little increase in the sales tax that they get. But it's like you can't count that because it's evil federal money. Well, it's evil federal money if you're building airplanes that drop bombs, but if you're paying for hospitals, then it's evil.
You can tell who the editorial voice in the room is here. We've got George Pyle, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm also joined in studio by David Noyce, who's a managing editor at the Tribune, and Dan Harry, government and politics editor at the Salt Lake Tribune. I want to turn to one more story before we go to our underplayed stories of the week. And Dan Harry, this has to do with a line item veto that Governor Gary Herbert used on Wednesday, just the day before yesterday, to get rid of $800,000 in tax spending. What was that money for?
It was for a sound wall of a property that is undeveloped right now. And it was outside of what the Transportation Department does, which is it evaluates different areas and it will put in sound walls in neighborhoods where there's a lot of noise by nearby highways. They do not put in sound walls for vacant lots, for vacant parcels. And that's what this was. And I think that developer Bryson Garbett is probably pretty mad at our reporter Lee Davidson, who found this, you know, deep inside the last minute budget bill. It was on page 32 of a 66-page bill, one little item, and it said, you know, the legislature intends that a sound wall will go at this address. They even got the address wrong, which shows kind of the haste with which I think this was inserted. But yeah, the governor vetoed it, and although he vetoed it by saying this was an address that doesn't exist. So he didn't have to get into the whole, we're not going to do this special favor for a developer explanation.
The legislature, I mean, it's interesting. Does the legislature ever carve out money specifically for transportation projects like this?
Well, they do. It's usually not this pinpoint, for one specific person to benefit a developer. But yeah, they do carve out things. They have pet projects. You see a lot of that in when they do a highway bond, for instance, they'll carve out, they'll earmark money for special projects in their district or that benefits folks in their neck of the woods.
Do you know how how the $800,000 line item got into this budget bill?
It's kind of mysterious. The developer, Bryson Garbett, who's a prominent developer, well-known, been around for many years, was in the legislature himself back in the 80s. He hired a lobbyist, which is, you know, what companies do. And the lobbyist happened to be Greg Curtis, former House Speaker. And he's a pretty persuasive person up there in the legislature many years after he stepped down from the speaker's chair. And he said he talked to folks on the Executive Appropriations Committee and others. He would not name names about who he talked with. So we don't know exactly. But whoever it was had the ability to insert money into that final bill of bills.
And then see it stripped away in a line item veto by Governor Gary Herbert. George, go ahead, Dan.
I was just going to say, you know, there is a possibility that the legislature would override it. I would be very doubtful they would do it in this case.
George Pyle, spending at the legislature, I will just let you opine.
Well, I mean, this is another example of, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And even if the rest of us don't know who they know, it all comes together at the last minute. I mean, here it's 45 days, everything comes together at the last minute. In Kansas, it's 90 days, everything comes together at the last minute. Doesn't matter when your deadline is, everything goes up until the deadline. And only a few people know this and a few people know that. The deliberative aspect of the legislature is lost because everybody's in such a hurry, and people do each other favors. And that's why you have vetoes, and that's why you have line item vetoes. I mean, the governor wasn't put in a position where he had to choose to veto the entire bill because of this goofy thing. He has the power, which presidents don't have, but a lot of governors do, to just line something out and say, no, we're not going there.
Can presidents really not do line item vetoes?
No. They argue for that every once in a while, but that would change the whole dynamic of the way Congress works in log rolling and saying, well, we'll put my amendment in here and your amendment in here, and then we'll both vote for it.
They'd have to pass a budget anyway.
Right. you see how rarely it's used, though. The governor vetoed three line items. He vetoed this one and two others for programs that the bills that are associated with them didn't pass. So it's rare that he does it.
Okay, but happens from time to time. With that, let's now turn to our final segment of the show, which is Underplayed Stories of the Week. And David Noyce, we haven't heard from you in a little while. What's your pick for Underplayed Story?
I didn't know this was happening I didn't know this was happening until my reporter told me about it, but BYU has a marketing and communications team that is part of a national competition to boost the image of the hot dog.
Romney's favorite meat,
meat in quotes. But and apparently they have these presentations ready. And BYU's team apparently is very good at this. They've won regional competitions before, and they showed all their presentations to our reporter, who interestingly did not come back and say, "Let's all go get hot dogs." But nonetheless, I thought it was pretty fascinating. It's Kathy Stevenson's story.
Oh, I'll check it out. Is it just, you know, they put a carrot between the bun now and say, "Here's your solution." George Pyle, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
I want to say something in defense of Mike Lee.
Okay.
That's something you thought you'd never hear from me. But almost two weeks ago now, he made this goofy speech on the floor of the Senate that the answer to climate change was to have more babies. And he showed these pictures of if we really fought climate change, then in Alaska, we'd have to ride tauntauns. And here's this picture of Luke Skywalker on a tauntaun. And so Stephen Colbert, bless him, comes back. He realizes the Lord has delivered him into my hands. And so he makes fun of Mike Lee, and he's going to do Star Wars. Okay, I'll do Star Wars. There's a picture of Jar Jar Binks, and he says, Mike Lee is the Jar Jar Binks of the Senate. And that's where I think he went too far. Jar Jar Binks was the one who stood up in the Galactic Senate and moved to give the Chancellor supreme executive power. Mike Lee would never, ever do that. He is all Article One. He has a lot of goofy ideas. Making the president even more powerful is not among them. So I call foul on that.
Okay. George Pyle with a clarification on criticism of Senator Mike Lee. Dan Harry, your pick for Underplayed Story.
I'm going to go with a story that was in the paper today by Bethany Rogers, and it was how in Lehigh, the government has tried to crack down on kids and their moms who are drawing chalk art to advocate for clean air and against a nearby gravel pit. And a police officer was sent to one of the mother's homes, and the city maintains that what was done with this chalk art was criminal mischief. So be very, very careful if you're going to do any chalk art in Lehigh.
Okay. I'll check that story out. Hadn't seen it yet. Interesting pick. I'm going to go with the fact that in a new water report, federal hydrologists say that Utah's snowpack is doing very well. And that, let's see, yeah, statewide, the snowpack ranks substantially better than in 2017 and almost as good as the banner years of 2005 and 2011. Though don't forget that we live in a desert. Also, hydrologists warned that early hot weather could cause flooding, so beware of that as well. Managing editor David Noyce, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and editorial page editor George Pyle, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me this morning on Behind the Headlines.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to operations director Jesse Ellis and news intern Sarah Sadikon here at KCPW for their help, and to the team at UPR in Logan. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.